This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR. If you enjoy this MPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app.
Welcome to the Joy Jam. You are listening to Marie. I am the host of the show, and I think we are on podcast number 74. So I figured that possibly you're already
starting to get a bit sick and tired of my voice. Is that right? You're thinking, oh God, she's got an awful lot to say, that woman. If only she would get someone else to come in and relieve the tedium of that woman's voice. Because I do understand that as I've got older, I have developed quite the colloquial twang to my Kiwi accent, and now I sound a little bit like Linatawa. I'm okay with that. Always found Linatawa very humorous, actually. Jeanette McDonald, if you're listening. Anywho, that was to make a short story long. What I'm trying to tell you, lovely listeners, is today, my friends, I have a very special guest. I've reached out to this woman and I said, please, please, can you help my readers and my listeners have a bit of variety in their podcast listening week? And this woman said, yes, any chance to talk, and she was in. So I am talking to the wonderful Maggie Malone. Hello, Maggie.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay, so the way that Maggie and I met, I know it's going to sound a little bit like a lesbian dating site because it was over vaginas and monologues. No, it wasn't actually a lesbian dating site. It was a play that we were doing, The Vagina Monologues.
Awesome play.
Awesome play. Yeah. Awesome play. And I met Maggie there, and I told Maggie a story recently about the story that I had, this narrative that was going on and over in my head. And that was, the story I was telling myself was that Maggie hated me. Now, the evidence I used to collect this data was, every time I walked into the room, I felt Maggie look at me. That was it. That was the only evidence I had. So the stories I was telling myself was, when Maggie looked at me, she was thinking, dot, dot, dot. When I said this, Maggie was thinking, dot, dot, dot. And at the end of this play, I finally gathered up the courage to say something to Maggie. And Maggie, you may not even remember that now. I admitted to Maggie that I thought she hated me. And she said, no, I would like to get, you know, for us to get to know each other more. And it reminded me of that cardinal lesson that we cannot believe the stories that we tell ourselves, that we cannot believe the lies sometimes that we tell ourselves, that sometimes thoughts are just that. And just because they're a thought doesn't make it true, so we don't have to take them seriously. And I could have saved myself 6 months of angst by actually seeking clarification and asking Maggie, have I done something to offend you? I feel like maybe, you know, the story I'm telling myself is that you don't like me. So anyway, wow. Hi, Maggie.
Hello.
What makes you think? You know, how do you feel when I said that?
I'll clarify for you what was happening for me.
Yep.
Unbeknownst to me, I'd had a stroke and I was busy trying to remain upright. That's why I sat down so often in our rehearsals, because one of the side effects of my first stroke is it left me dizzy And so whenever you walked in the room, I looked at everybody that came in. And if I looked distracted, that's what it was. I was busy trying to sit upright. That's it. That's all that was happening. I wasn't thinking about you or anyone else. I was busy trying to sit on a chair and not fall off. That's it.
So it wasn't actually about me at all?
Not at all.
Well, fancy that.
Not at all. I was literally working hard to sit on a chair and stay upright. That's why I didn't do all of the exercises we did and the games. I couldn't run. I couldn't stand upright.
And at the time, you thought that you had a bung hip or you had a bung knee or something?
At the time, I didn't know what was happening. I figured it was something to do with my ears and my balance. So that's why I was always sitting down. It took another 6 months for the results to come back and say I'd had a stroke. In fact, I'd had several little ones, but nobody knew that at the time.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I can tell now based, you know, we've done a couple of plays together. If we think about the Sunday script sessions at Centrepoint, your speech is a little different.
Yep. As a result of my last stroke in September, I now have a stutter and my speech is a bit fragmented, which is ironic because it comes as a surprise to me every day. My inner monologue, if I'm reading or if I'm thinking by myself, is fluent and fast.
Yeah.
I can't make my mouth keep up.
Right.
Yeah. Which some people are really grateful for because it does occasionally make me have to stop and think about what I'm saying. Oh, but what I have discovered is I swear more, a lot more.
Oh, so what's your favourite word?
Fuck.
Fuck!
Yeah.
It's a bit like fuck.
It's an awesome word. Awesome word.
What's your favourite part of the word fuck?
I love how it comes out of your mouth, how it can be an explosive word, or like you just did, express awe or wonder with it.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's so many different emotions I feel like the word fuck encompasses.
Yeah.
You know, it can be horror, it can be anger, it can be fuck,
yeah.
Wonder, as you say.
It can also be joy.
Yes.
Fuck!
Yeah,
when somebody tells you really good news and you just can't think of any other word.
Yeah.
I think it's one of my favourite words.
My mum, she always had a saying and she would say, it's a bit like hey. Whether she was telling us off or whatever, she would say, it's a bit like hey. Or there would be other ways that she would say it and it would change the meaning of that phrase. And then one day, this was towards the end of her life, so we're full in the throes of cancer, and she looked at me and she said, oh, it's a bit like fuck. And I looked at her and she looked at me and she said, oh, yeah, I say fuck now.
Mm.
And suddenly this phrase of it's a bit like hey had turned into it's a bit like fuck.
Yeah.
And that was the only way she knew to describe this cancerous journey that she was on was with the word fuck.
I've spoken to so many people who have had strokes and I nearly drowned actually recently in the hydrotherapy pool because I met a fella and all he can do is swear. Lovely man, gorgeous family, but all he can do is swear. And the more he was trying not to swear because we just met, the more he was swearing. And that made us giggle so much I lost my footing in the hydrotherapy pool, which made us laugh even harder and we both went, fuck.
And you went under.
Yeah, it was so funny. But yeah, the physio had to get in and hold us both up. But that's all right. We're not allowed in the hydrotherapy pool together anymore.
Oh, now, listeners, I mean, just I'm looking at Maggie. She's got the biggest, most beautiful smile on her face, and she's giggling away, and actually she's talking about almost drowning in the hydrotherapy pool as she's doing rehab from her stroke. Can you see where the vein of this thread of this podcast is going? That, and this is why I've got Maggie on this show, because we've discussed a lot about the fact that shit is always going to happen,
mm-hmm.
that the bad times are always going to come, that people that say, you know, only good things are coming from here on in, they're bloody lying.
Absolutely.
They're burying their head in the sand, that there is always bad things around the corner. But I think you are an amazing example of you refuse to let that take your joy.
I think I learned early on as a kid, bad things are only what you decide are bad things. Who's to say what actually is a bad thing? Not getting a job could work out to be a good thing when you find out that the boss is an asshole.
Yeah.
You might just have spared me many years of trauma and drama. Or not hanging out with the fella that you really like, you might find is a good thing, because he might be someone that's a little too handsy with his fist. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
For me, I'm alive. I woke up this morning and I can get out of bed.
Yeah.
I could get myself dressed. I can still drive, which I'm deeply grateful for. I'm loved. There's money in the bank. Granted, it's not as much money as I'd like in the bank, but there's money in the bank. There's food in my bank. I've got so much to be grateful for. And, yeah, I try not to look at everything and think, oh, it's bad. Mm-mm. I don't know enough yet to make that decision. I don't. And having had three strokes this year has certainly made me think about what is bad.
Yeah.
And how long do I have to, or how long do I choose to believe that something is bad? Mm-mm. There's joy in all the moments. Both my eyeballs work. Both my ears work. My arms and my legs work. I'm free. I was lucky enough because of the nature of what I've got that's caused the strokes. I was lucky enough to be given some of my KiwiSaver. So I'm debt free. I never thought that would happen at 55. Yeah. I just got so much to be happy about. I really do.
Yeah.
Every day I wake up and I do the top to toe check. Can I move my hands? Can I move my feet? Is everything working independently? Yep. Then I got plenty to be happy about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were saying earlier, how did you described it so eloquently, but, you know, this idea of you've cut through the bullshit pretty quickly because time's uncertain. You know, explain that to me. I can't quite remember how you said it.
So the nature of how I've had three strokes in 1 year is because I've got some rare stupid genetic disease. There is nothing like finding that what you've got is going to shorten your life to make you just cut through the crap. And we worry about so much crap. 99% will never happen. It just won't. No matter how bad you think it's going to be, it'll be a different kind of bad that will turn up on some random Tuesday morning for no good reason. I've had my random Tuesday morning. Yep. I'm ready for whatever life brings, but I will work hard every day to find joy in it, to find something to smile about or laugh about or connect with all the people that are important to me.
Yep.
Yeah. There's nothing like this to make you focus on what's important. But you can be miserable every day of the week if you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No matter how much you've got in your life, right?
Ah, truly. I was talking to friends recently who have got a stupendous amount of money coming in their house every week. and it's not enough. And you're just like, I don't understand. That maths doesn't make sense for me. But then you realise for them this is their version of normal and it's not good enough for them. No. I refuse to be miserable. I really do. There just isn't any point. How can I be miserable in a world where Skittles exist? They are gorgeous.
Skittles are good.
Yeah, and they've made big ones that are chewier in the middle.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that this exists.
They are glorious. Yeah. How can I be miserable in a world in which sugar exists?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And donuts. That's true. You were telling me earlier about you learned a valuable lesson when you were 10. Oh. Now, me, I was just learning how to pick my nose at 10. I don't think I was very profound thinking at all, apart from wanting to be rich and famous. I don't think my thinking had got too far beyond that. Tell me what lesson you learned when you were 10 years old.
So I'll go backwards before I got to 10. When I was about 8, I looked around at my family and went, nah, I don't know who these people are. They must have kidnapped me. So I'm not from this tribe. So I went looking for my birth certificate and I found it. And it had my mum and my dad's name on it. And I cried for half a day. I was so despondent.
Really thought you were adopted.
Oh, I was hoping, not thinking. I was hoping. I was hoping they'd stolen me from somewhere and the paper would prove it. Nah, it had my parents' name on it. I was like, oh, it's real. I'm actually of these people.
So dysfunctional family?
Oh, Jesus. Once were warriors for real. That's how we grew up.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I watched, I will never watch that film again. Not because it's not good. For me, that felt like an autobiography.
Right.
And it was too raw, too real. I'd never seen anything like that on a screen. That was awful.
So you grew up in England?
Yeah.
Didn't you?
Yep.
Yeah.
Both parents are migrants. They were... Both parents are Jamaican, and they brought their dysfunction with them. It was horrific, yeah. Probably the most stressful day of my childhood that I can recall was the day they didn't fight. I don't know what happened, but they decided not to fight. It was an awful day.
Walking on eggshells
all day. Till about 7 o'clock when the fighting started, and literally all my brothers and sisters, we all went, whew. Because we knew how that worked. We knew how long they would argue for, roughly. And we knew how it would end. Somebody would get a smack. Then us kids would get involved. Probably some of us would get a bit of a smack as well. And then by bedtime, it would be all calm and we could get some sleep. Yeah, that was normal. That was every day. I can't remember a day apart from that one when we didn't fight.
And so... You know, thinking that a 10-year-old can already decide, oh, no, this is not for me, explain, as much as you can remember, that thought process that went into.
I remember that clearly. I was always a reader. I read really early. So I started reading at 3, and I learnt to read because my parents read the newspaper.
Right.
And so I learnt to read upside down. And as they read the paper, I would point out words. And I still remember that. And that's how I got interested in reading. And then I found books and realised, hang on a minute, people don't live like we do. Oh, I wonder if this is all crap in this book. This is just fiction. This is all made up stuff. And that was easy conclusion to come to as a kid because I grew up in the UK in the 70s and 99% of the books I read didn't have black kids in. So it was really easy as a black kid to go, oh, these books are all about white people, so this is not real. This is not how real people live. This is how white people live. Black people, clearly, what we're doing is normal. And then I was lucky enough to go to school with a really good teacher who really opened my eyes to books and said, no, read more. So I read and I read and I read. And I remember I was 10. It was the summer of 77. Really good summer in the UK. We were all out playing, and I looked at them all. And we'd had a big stoush in the house, as normal.
And had a big what?
Big fight in house. And I remember looking at our house thinking, no, I don't want to live like this forever. And if I ever have kids, I don't want my kids to go through what I'm going through. Yeah. And I remember vowing to myself, I am not going to repeat this shit. I'm just not. And probably 2 or 3 years later, I remember finding a book that literally changed my life, which was I'm Okay, You're Okay. And it talks about the theory of transactional analysis.
What is transactional analysis?
So it talks.
I'm only asking for the reader,
of
you
course.
Know, for the viewers. Viewers, readers, no. What are
listeners.
They? They're listeners. Yeah. They're listening. Yeah.
I know that you are an expert, but I'll explain for your listening public.
I don't know what transactional analysis is, clearly. Disclaimer. Okay.
And
as we were.
Yeah, I probably don't have a good explanation of it, but it is basically talking about how as human beings we live in one of three states. We are either in a parental state and we treat everybody as kids, or we're in an adult state, which is the ideal, or we're in a child state. And what I realized after reading that book was that my parents very much vacillated between parent and child. That's how they related to one another. And there are different types of parents. There's a whole positive parenting going on in there and really negative, toxic parenting, which is what we were experiencing every day. And that, and another book called Games People Play, and I've got copies of both. Those two books opened my mind. They were both revolutionary and revelatory to me.
Yeah.
I never knew that this stuff existed.
So to be an adult thinker, I'm thinking like there's the parent thinker, the child thinker, and then the adult thinker. What qualities does that adult thinker possess? Like what is different about that?
You're rational, reasonable. You will negotiate things. You will analyze things in a fair perspective.
Right.
Yeah. You'll be looking about win-win situations, not about somebody has to lose for me to win.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So if you're in the parent's state, that's okay, so long as everybody you're dealing with is sitting in another child's state and is willing to be parented. But you can be stuck in a parent state and trying to parent everyone, but they don't need it or want it.
That would be the rescuers.
Totally. Yep. Whoosh straight in. Yep. I've got you. You don't have to do anything. I've got you. But I might not need you or want you.
Yeah.
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 And then you can go from there and be a martyr because somebody's rejected all your fabulous help. Well, I didn't need it in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can see how that can go on and on and on for years.
Absolutely.
And kids can, through no fault of their own, be stuck in that child space. Or if you're a child of an addict, alcoholic or a drug addict, you can be pushed into the parent state because you have to look after the grown-ups in your life all the time. And they can be stuck in the child state. I'm incapacitated. I can't look after myself. I can't pay the bills. Yeah.
So, and what's the – and now I'm asking because the way you've described that describes my daughter who's had to parent both her father and I since she was a little girl for a whole bunch of reasons, addiction being one of them, my car accident being another – being in an abusive relationship, being in another, not with her father, with my son's father.
Mm.
But when I think about it, she really has had to parent us since she was probably 7. What are the implications for a kid like that?
She can get stuck parenting. she can find a partner that she can parent. And that can be worrying. She cannot necessarily know herself outside of that role of being a parent. So it's really difficult for her to find.
Do they struggle parenting themselves?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
I did. I struggled to be nice to me.
Yeah.
I had to learn that I'm worthy of good relationships, good adult relationships.
Yeah.
Because that used to feel very false. Yeah. If I'm not being needed, then what's my purpose in life?
Yep. How do you think you've learned how to be worthy?
Oh, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of therapy. Yeah. And reading.
Yeah.
So much reading. From 10, I've always been interested in psychology.
Yeah.
I want to know about the games people play and why we play those games and how we can remain unaware. You're in the game, but you're not sure you don't know you're in the game.
Mm-hmm.
You just know when you're losing.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, so I wanted to know, okay, what are the games I'm playing? Why am I playing them?
Yeah.
Where has this come from? Yeah, and I know it's cliche, and I know it's an old trope, but an awful lot of this is our childhood.
Yeah.
And for me, I needed to look in and look backwards and be honest about where I've come from.
Yeah.
And we were taught very much as a kid, don't involve the world, don't tell the truth, keep everybody out. We will preserve the lie.
Yeah.
Yeah, so often people will talk about the truth teller in a family,
mm-hmm.
which most people are not grateful for that person.
No. I remember a few hidings I got simply for telling the truth. And I now know as an adult what that taught me was I wasn't safe with the truth, that actually it was safer to lie.
It was safer to play the game, to be involved, keep the lie alive.
Yeah.
What that did for me as a kid was really made me question, what am I seeing? And is it as bad as it feels?
Yeah.
Or am I just being sensitive and dramatic?
And is that probably what you were told?
Well, I was told many, many times that I was sensitive and to stop being so stupid. Yeah, all the time. But I'm lucky. I have enough of a brain that my brain went, nah, fuck this. We're not having this. I know what the truth was. I was there. I'm not playing this game anymore, thank you.
Yeah.
You guys have laid out the board and all of the pieces, and you've given me the dice. I'm going to hand them back. I'm not playing.
What an amazingly astute, insightful young woman you were.
I must have been annoying as hell.
Yeah, I can't imagine it going down well for the people that was directly affected from this astute observations.
I've always been grateful that I have a reasonable IQ. I've always been grateful that I've had a really good vocabulary. I love language. But I'm sure my family was not happy about my vocabulary because I used to use it on all of them. Yeah.
There's nothing like the articulate warrior.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And I was that kid.
Yeah.
I would use my vocabulary mainly because I was aware my family didn't understand a lot of the words I was chucking at them. And I can use my very, very English accent and call them all sorts of idiots with some, 50-cent words.
Yeah. Which, love it.
Yeah, I knew they were never going to look up. Yeah. So it might sound like I was saying something nice because I learned how to smile when I was saying the words.
Yeah.
But nah, I was calling you all sorts of a doofus.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I can't believe that we've already talked for nearly 29 minutes.
No.
Luckily, I have asked Maggie to do a double episode with me so that next week when you listen in, it's also going to be Maggie. But just in case you don't get to that, I need to ask you our favourite flavour of ice cream.
Oh, actually, really, really good vanilla. I hate cheap vanilla ice cream.
Yes, yep, like a like Capri's vanilla bean pod.
Absolutely.
Type of ice cream.
Which I shouldn't be eating because I'm lactose intolerant.
Yeah, understand you. Mm. Ice cream, it was the one thing to I could ask safely because I don't eat it. But if we were talking biscuits, we could fill up a 30-minute episode just on bloody biscuit flavours. I tell you, Cookie Monster's in the house. Anyway, thank you, Maggie, for this half of the interview. Tune in next week and you can hear part two with Maggie.
Thank you for having me.
If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. NPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out npr.nz for more information. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.